You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Robert Pippin, the Evelyn Stephenson Neff Distinguished Service Professor of Philosophy at the University of Chicago and author of The Culmination. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
That's been a kind of transformation for me. I'm speaking to you now from upstate New York, where we have a country home, a farm with 50 acres, and we're very isolated. We're very much in nature all around us. I don't have any neighbors. We're at the end of a long dirt road, very far back in the woods. And I had always been an urbanite most of my life and agreed with Hegel that a painting of nature is actually more interesting than nature. There's some intelligence behind it. I don't like to believe any of that. There's something humbling. And, you know, what Kant said was that our appreciation of beauty, our ability to appreciate beauty, means that we are not merely sensible creatures of pleasure. We don't treat the beauty of nature as something we want to own to amuse ourselves. I mean, some people do, but they don't really get it. The beauty of nature is an indication of a kind of purposiveness in nature that fits us at a level beyond our mere senses, inclinations, desire to satisfy ourselves. Something about the significance of the beautiful in nature reassures us that we have a higher vocation than mere entertainment and enjoyment. Some solemnity, sublimity in our ability to appreciate the beauty of nature is encouraging.
You know, you were talking there before about what Heidegger said about the hidden. If we don't care about things, they stay hidden. And because there are limits to our care, to be alive is to be surrounded by the hidden. And as we awaken to this environmental crisis, what are your reflections on climate change, the biodiversity loss, and our responsibility to future generations?
Nothing terribly original. It's terrible. We shouldn't do it. And we should be very, very mindful of our duties to future generations. We know we shouldn't be doing it. We know we're facing the extermination of life on the planet, and we've not stopped doing it. The measures are inadequate. And I don't think we understand why we find it so difficult when we're faced with such a catastrophe not to be able to rally a powerful international movement with restrictions on what's causing the problem. Why can't we fix it?
Yes, I think that, you know, the technology is there, which is great. It just took a long time to develop it. If we had access to some of these technologies before, and of course, we know there have been powerful lobbies as well that hid information from people. As someone who has reflected a lot on and must be able to accept your own mortality, a lot of us feel like it's in our mind that, oh, we have forever. So our conception of time is really unrealistic, I feel, on this issue.
I think you're right. But again, I think even though there are sort of strategic and political reasons why those with an interest in our not stopping have contributed to our not stopping doing this, I don't really sense, except among a certain level of educated elites in the West, a really deep understanding of our commitment to economic prosperity as a superordinate value. I mean, for one thing, climate change restrictions so that we can have an end to the catastrophic effects of climate change often don't take into account the inequalities it would require for the first and third world difference. I mean, to tell India and China don't use any coal when the livelihood of so many of their citizens depends on the only energy resource they have, given that we've enjoyed, you know, sort of our time in the sun, they say quite rightly, not yet. We got to get to where you are before we worry about that. I think that's another way of saying that the economic imperative just seems unavoidable to those societies. It's not even conceivable that there could be another way of living that won't achieve the standard of living in the West, but is an acceptable and humane way of living that prevents climate change, just doesn't seem to get any grip.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes a bit sanctimonious to tell other countries to have degrowth when they're just getting their growth.
Yeah. What a terrible problem. But if we could adopt a way of living that wasn't so exploitative and wasteful, it might provide a model. Or you say, oh, yeah, we're going to do it. So, you know, but we can't bring ourselves to do it. At some point, when I was writing a book about, say, Hegel's Science of Logic, I realized that the only other philosopher who had the same interpretation that I did was Martin Heidegger. So wanting to understand why Heidegger thought that Hegel's position fundamentally didn't work, that something had been left out, that something had been forgotten or missed, led me to a very serious engagement with Heidegger's major works. Heidegger's term is destruction of the metaphysical tradition, and it's a little extreme. It sounds like he's sort of taking a shotgun and trying to trying to kill it. But when Heidegger says he wants to destroy the Western tradition, I think he wants to destroy the priority of a certain kind of insistence that before anything else is important, the facts are important. So Heidegger thought we had prioritized the question of knowledge to such a degree that we had given it a kind of significance as the primordial relationship to being, to all of reality, that he thought had excluded other areas of significance in human life, and by excluding them, allowed us to think of the world as, in a way, there for us. So that being in the world is just that which could be the subject of a discursive assertion. And of course, he connected this to the kind of predatory stance of contemporary technology, which is essentially destroying the world because it considers the world as just material stuff, which we can understand and manipulate for our own ends. So that whole interrogative cognitive approach to the world has consequences for the way we think of ourselves as objects in the same way as objects of cognition, the way we think of ourselves in terms of medicine, of the economy, of business. And I don't think Heidegger has any objection to rationality. I think he wants us to think more about rationality as an issue of meaning in human life, about forms of thought other than discursive assertion with fixed truth conditions, that there's a form of truth that is not a form of correspondence between propositions in the world, but a form of disclosure of something being shown to us that we haven't been able to see without art, painting, or music, or fiction, or poetry. Heidegger's notion of truth is a much more experiential and less propositionalizable experiential dimension when he talks about revelation or disclosure. And the difficulty is that when philosophers hear that something in a novel by Henry James or a poem by Wallace Stevens has been disclosed, that we see something truthfully in a way that we haven't seen before, thanks to the work of art, philosophers want to say, well, if you're telling me that something is disclosed by the wasteland that we wouldn't understand otherwise, what is it? And that means translate that into a proposition. You're inevitably led to empiricism, that there has to be some empirical confirmation condition that can defend the claim that you've understood something truthfully by the appreciation of an artwork. I think really the experiential implications of teaching things like the arts to kind of awaken a humility in students about what they don't know and what needs to be thought about, but not thought about in terms of articles for professional philosophy journals, but considered in a way in which conversations among people in classrooms reading really interesting texts together can start to illuminate what we don't know and what we've taken for granted in a way that we shouldn't be. There's something about reading Shakespeare together in a classroom that I have more hope in if it's taught well and if it's animated by a sense of seriousness than professional moral philosophy. But even that is disappearing as literature, for example, is taught more as a kind of example of a sociological way of understanding what kind of society would produce literature like this, rather than the kind of awakening and humbling that Heidegger is hoping for. There are these non-disclosive modalities of intelligibility. They don't need to be colonized by philosophy to be significant and perhaps even more significant than various lists of propositions. If you ask somebody, what did it mean to you that all of your friends were killed in the war? You don't expect a list of propositions in psychological prose. What you expect is a narrative, a kind of story. You don't expect, well, it means proposition one, proposition two, proposition three. You want a kind of account that will help you feel, or what Heidegger said, be attuned to Stimmtzeit, being attuned to this mode of disclosure in a way that doesn't allow itself to be reformulable propositionally. And the kind of dominance of the scientific attitude that anything that isn't formulable this way is, you know, basically bullshit, indeterminate, vague, mystical, that is destroying us, according to Heidegger. It is so limiting our capacities for understanding ourselves that we have become, in a way, thoughtless in the pursuit of a kind of efficient control of the environment for the sake of maximum preference satisfaction, the contemporary economistic model of rationality, that we've lost touch with what any of this struggle for control and manipulation is for. And this is, of course, one of the most controversial things in Heidegger. That the original understanding of being as knowable intelligibility has influenced an enormous number of practices that Heidegger thinks eventually have cut us off from all sources of meaning in a possible life other than this successful control of the environment for our own satisfaction. And in that sense, he wants to destroy that. He wants to find a way of showing us that this way of living is actually destroying us existentially, refusing to allow us to confront other sources of meaning in ways that aren't really formulable in discursive propositional prose, not really subject to the kind of truth conditions we insist on. And Heidegger thinks we may have reached a point where we're not even able to say anymore, this is the worst, where we have forgotten so much that we think of what would be experienced as the worst as normal, as just the everyday, as just what life is. So great literature, especially modernist literature, which is literature of alienation and despair and doubt, can awaken us at least to what we've lost. Well, I don't think there is, you know, quote unquote, a way out. I think well-meaning people should continue to work towards a woman's right to control her own health care, early childhood education, universal health care with a single payer system, all of the things that seem right now in the political climate in the United States impossible. Everybody just ought to do what they can to achieve these ends. But I'm not quite sure that given the underlying assumptions we have about why they're important, they're strong enough, these intentions that we have to moderate the effects of inequality and so forth, are really adequate to the situation we face today, which is so dominated by economistic, technological imperatives that the goodwill of individuals, which I hope will survive, isn't really much to hang a lot of hope on.
What do you imagine for the future of education evolving to prepare students for the future of work?
Well, again, I sound like Eeyore here. I'm very pessimistic. People of my generation who were professors from roughly the 1960s to the 1980s, early 90s, lived in the greatest period to be a professor, to be in education in the history of the world. More privilege, more money, more leisure, more access by more students. I mean, look at me. I'm first generation to college person who ended up at the University of Chicago and traveled all over the world, lectured everywhere. But all of that is coming to an end. Been coming to an end for 10 to 15 years now, and vocationalization is one aspect of it. But again, the fact that we find this inevitable, that there's nothing we can do about it, that these are just economic imperatives that can't be resisted because they're the rational way of doing things, and the treatment of the humanities, especially as what you do when you're not working to amuse yourself, I think that will just grow. And the transformation of the universities into these highly administered STEM and vocational schools will only increase, and that will filter down to the training in the high schools and even in the grade schools. So I think the state of education is in a dire crisis at all levels, but especially at the university level. The elite universities, the ones with a lot of money, will survive for another couple of generations. The parents will want their children to get vocational degrees, but they won't mind if they get a little culture on the side. So those universities will do all right, but public universities will be under extreme pressure, even extreme political pressure, as in states like Texas and Florida, that will end free academic life as we've known it for a couple hundred years now.
You know, what are your reflections on the spread of misinformation and the erosion of trust in institutions? What measures we can take to foster a robust and ethical fourth estate?
Well, now, you know, we're dealing with opinions that would require a great deal more argument to defend, but I think social media companies ought to be held liable for what they post. This is a large controversy that we don't really write this, so it's not us. We just provide a forum for it being available. I don't agree with that. I think the consequences of that have been so calamitous that if they publish things that are defamatory or false, they have to be suable. I think that'll solve the problem in a week. But, you know, I get the academic freedom issue. I get the ACLU position on this and so forth. But I think the erosion of public life, of the public sphere by the social media companies has been so catastrophic, and the venom and hatred they've allowed to proliferate. We would never allow newspapers to publish this stuff. And the idea that they're behind the shield of saying, well, we didn't write it. But that's my opinion. I gather it's contestable. I know a lot of very intelligent people who think we shouldn't do that, but I certainly think we ought to make social media companies liable for the harm that they've done to society.
It's been such a fascinating conversation. But as you think about the future and your search for knowledge and meaning and the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Just, it doesn't have to be like this. That's it.
Well, that says everything.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.